case on the argument calendar. Shown on the calendar is Dole versus United States. I think it's really Kimberly versus United States. Dole is the applicant for intervention.
In any event,
Dole is the appellant, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. This case presents the question of whether a district court can order equitable relief against a federal agency.
Speak a little louder. Put that microphone close to you.
I thought I was speaking too loud. This case presents the question of whether a federal district court can order equitable relief against a federal agent in the face of the express terms of a federal statute. My name is Robert Mankey. I represent the appellant Ann Doe, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes of time for rebuttal. We have two appeals today, one on the denial of intervention to my client below and one from the merits of the judgment, and I would like to turn first to the issues that go to the merits of the judgment and are below, and there are three parts to my argument. The first is that this Court's prior decision in the Kimberly case didn't resolve the issues before the Court on this appeal, did not dictate the entry of judgment below. Second, then, presented is the question of how ordinary principles of contract interpretation applied in this case affect the judgment entered below, and whether judgment was properly entered on the contract at issue here under ordinary principles of contract interpretation. And then third, even if the contract between the Farmers Home Administration and Kimberly expressly waived the congressional power to pass the OLIPA statute, was that authority delegated to the Farmers Home Administration by Congress in the early 80s? Because it was not expressly delegated, even if the contract says what Kimberly has argued that it says, nevertheless, injunctive relief is not appropriate, and the only remedy available to Kimberly is money damages.
Let me ask you this. What after our opinion in Kimberly 1, what was the district court's mandate? How do you understand the district court's mandate when it was returned?
Your Honor, Kimberly 1 raised
You said in your opening remarks that after the remand in Kimberly 1, that didn't dictate a judgment in favor of Kimberly.
No, Your Honor. The government.
But in your view, did Kimberly 1 mean then? What was there for the. What did the district court have to decide? Putting aside the settlement, what did the district court have to decide in order to enter a judgment in favor of Kimberly?
Let me answer that in two ways. First, the government moved to dismiss very early in the case and raised only two defenses. First, that sovereign immunity wasn't waived, and second, that the unmistakability doctrine applied and barred Kimberly's claims. And those were the only issues in front of the first panel. So the first panel ruled against the government on both of those issues, but then remanded to the district court to entertain the case with any other defendants.
Well, the district court's going to look at our opinion and is going to follow what we said. Now, why did the district court – what you're telling us is that the district court misunderstood our holding in Kimberly 1, and I want to know in what way or how.
The district court ruled that OLIPA does not apply. And that is a misapprehension of what the first panel said. The ruling of the first panel was that OLIPA was not a sovereign act within the meaning of the sovereign acts doctrine. I think it's either the third or the fourth special defense discussed in the Winstar decision. That doesn't mean that OLIPA is null and void, that it's not an act of Congress. And so the mistake.
But it didn't apply in this particular circumstance, though, didn't it? Isn't that what the panel opinion said?
I don't believe the panel opinion said it didn't apply. It said that it.
What was the effect of the panel opinion?
No, Your Honor.
That way.
Well, the effect of the panel opinion only because the government had raised an unmistakability defense to a contract action. But that doesn't mean that ALIPA is not a validly enacted federal statute that is the law of the land. And just to illustrate
that. Was it possible that the panel opinion only applied to those contracts that had been issued before ALIPA passed?
I had not thought about that distinction. I don't think that distinction is material to the argument we're making. What we're suggesting is that the government cannot raise ALIPA, it cannot raise an unmistakability doctrine defense to a contract action brought under ALIPA, but that doesn't mean the government can't raise any of the other defenses set out in Winstar, or indeed, setting aside the special defenses available to the government in contract action, the government simply could have argued that the contract at issue in this case doesn't provide Kimberly with the relief that Kimberly is seeking. And that's our second argument. And I would rely on footnote 24 of Winstar, says in part, if an alleged term could not be discovered under normal standards, meaning normal standards of contract interpretation, there would be no need for an unmistakability doctrine. We have that situation in reverse. The first panel decided that the unmistakability doctrine did not apply. It never turned to the questions of contract interpretation that you would then have to reach, that the district court would then have to reach to enter judgment. And the reason it did that is that the government never raised these arguments. So I'm not suggesting that the panel, you know, that the panel didn't fully dispose of the issues in front of it. The only defenses that the government raised.
Here's the problem I had with your whole attack on the judgment on the merits, and that is in Kimberly 1, towards the end of the opinion, we said in the context of federal programs, it appears relatively few loans were affected, perhaps numbering less than 5,000. That's where I got the 5,000. Of these private contracts between the third-party trustee and borrowers would be to give the government as contractor powers that private contractor parties lack. Such a result cannot be countenanced because the government in its private contracting capacity cannot exercise sovereign power. Now, when it goes back down to the district court is sort of stuck with this.
Your Honor, construe broadly that sentence is dicta as to issues just not in front of the court. What I take that sentence to mean is that as a function of the unmistakability doctrine, the government cannot evade contractual liability categorically by relying on ALIPA. We know from Franconia Associates that the government has to pay money damages for breaching the contracts. It repudiated the contracts that it had pre-ALIPA when it passed ALIPA, and we know that the government is responsible for money damages. That does not mean that the contract between Kimberly and Farmers Home Administration in 1981 entitled Kimberly to be exempted from a subsequent act of Congress. All that it means is that the government breached its contract with Kimberly, but that only begs the question of what the remedy is. And Winstar instructs that you apply normal standards of contractual interpretation to the contract at issue here.
So from your perspective, the government breaches its contract with Kimberly. Kimberly can get damages, but the project nonetheless still must remain until there's compliance with ALIPA.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
A 515 program.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. If the vice of ALIPA is that Congress engaged in social policy and imposed the cost of that social policy on the developers, then the cure for that vice is to spread those costs to taxpayers through an award of damages so that Kimberly doesn't have to bear the cost of the Section 515 program itself. But what Kimberly is seeking to do here is to opt out of ALIPA and to undo the benefits and protections that tenants like my client received. And there is just simply no authority at all, either in Winstar or this Court's prior decision or anywhere else in the case law for that. It's an extraordinary proposition. And I think that there is confusion engendered in a lot of the case law because people are usually suing the government for money damages. So
I want to get back to something more basic. You didn't mention this as one of your 3 points, but I think this is one of the reasons the government's not here today, and that is that the case has been settled. There's no action pending in the district court. Why isn't this case moot? Why isn't your appeal moot?
Your Honor, the case was settled on a settlement dictated by the terms of the judgment entered in the district court. And so if this...
Well, it doesn't matter what dictated it. It was a voluntary act. It's a settlement. You know, it's gone.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. The case is on appeal. And
you can undo the settlement?
Your Honor, that's for the district court to decide. All that this court can do is reverse the judgment entered by the district court and remand. And then there's a question to the district court about the effect of the settlement.
Reverse what judgment?
Reverse
the judgment pursuant to the settlement?
I don't believe there's a judgment pursuant to settlement. The settlement was post-judgment. All that the government did when it settled was
pursuant to the settlement, it was the case was dismissed.
So, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear the question.
I thought the action was dismissed by the district court pursuant to the settlement.
Your Honor, the district court entered judgment before the settlement. The government appealed. The government then dropped its appeal when it settled. So everything that Kimberly, the interest that Kimberly has in the property has by virtue of the judgment entered by the district court, all that the government could do at that point was drop its appeal. If you reverse the judgment entered by the district court and remand to the district court, presumably the government will then appear in the district court and it will either say, we don't wish to continue fighting this case.
No, there's no controversy anymore between the plaintiff and the defendant. You're a would-be defendant in the intervention, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
You want to assert a defense. Is that what you want to do?
Yes, Your Honor.
But there's no action in which to assert a defense.
Your Honor, my client is harmed by the judgment entered by the district court. It's certainly not unusual for...
Why don't you just start your own action?
Your Honor, we could sue, as Kimberly asked last week, by seeking judicial notice of a complaint filed by tenants against the government. We could sue the government to try to ensure compliance with the APA and ensure compliance with the LIPA. But that doesn't help Ms. Doe, because if this case, if the judgment of the district court is not reversed, Ms. Doe will be evicted. What Kimberly is trying to do is sell the property to a bona fide third-party purchaser, and if Kimberly can transfer the property, I suppose we could then go to the district court on a new action and ask that that whole transaction be undone. I think this court has jurisdiction over the appeal from the judgment. It's the district court's judgment that harms Ms. Doe. And if the government, if you reverse and remand, the government may come into the district court and say, our settlement was just to drop the appeal. But since the case has been reversed, we're going to continue to litigate, in which case Ms. Doe and the government will be aligned against Kimberly. Alternatively, the government may say part of our deal with Kimberly is that we wouldn't litigate this further at all. And in that case, we have a cause of action against the government to try to enforce the terms of OLIPA. All of this happened after the appeals were taken. And so all that we know about the settlement is from what Kimberly has filed in this court in the first instant. We've had no discovery about this. We don't know anything more about the settlement other than what the court does. And as an advocate, it makes me very uncomfortable to be arguing the law and facts of a deal that I'm not party to. The proper course is for the court to remand to the district court for the district court to sort this out.
Is there anything stopping you from going down to the district court and filing your own action?
Your Honor, I think the district court would defer to this court because, as I say, the interest that Kimberly has in the property.
Maybe answer my question. Why can't you just go over to the district court and file a new complaint?
I don't think we get anywhere in the district court. And because Kimberly...
Because of Kimberly 1?
Kimberly now has clear... No, because of the district court decision in Kimberly. Kimberly now has clear title to the property. The only impediment to its transferring the property is this court's stay.
There's been a reconveyance filed and a satisfaction of judgment filed.
Your Honor, I note that some of that was filed after the order for stay that we asked this court to order, and so I'm a little perplexed about how it can be that this court can order Kimberly to preserve the status quo ante pending this appeal, and then additional steps are taken in the district court to frustrate my client's ability to appeal. All that we're asking is that the status quo ante be preserved so that the judgment of the district court can be reviewed. I think if this court reverses the judgment on the merits, the district court can sort out whether...
Is it part of your position that the reconveyance and the satisfaction of judgment were in violation of the stay?
In violation of the...
Of the stay order issued by this court?
My recollection, and I wish I were more certain about this, my recollection is at least some of the steps that you're referring to took place after the stay order. But... In any event, there's no doubt in my mind that the district court would have the jurisdiction to unpack this deal and return the situation to the the prior state if the judgment is reversed. Kimberly doesn't have an interest in the property by virtue of a settlement. It has an interest in the property by virtue of the judgment. The settlement, all that the government could do once it settled was drop its appeal. That doesn't give Kimberly clear title. All that it does is means that the appeal is dropped. The other argument I want to make on the merits that we only touched on is that the Farmers Home Administration was in no way authorized to waive Congress's power to pass a LIPA. And so even if the contract here contemplated that if Congress passed a statute like a LIPA, that Kimberly would not be required to comply with the terms of the statute, that Kimberly would be protected from future statutes, that was a statute that the Farmers Home Administration was without the power, without the authority to pass.
So what are you seeking to do here, to enjoin?
We're defending
the government from filing a prepayment scheme here, unless there's compliance with the LIPA.
Yes, Your Honor. We just want the projects to stay in the Section 515 program, unless there's compliance with the terms of a LIPA.
You don't believe that Kimberly could comply with a LIPA?
Kimberly could. It chose not to. Instead of trying to comply with the statutory terms, it filed an action to quiet title. So we're defending, and you'd have to ask a government lawyer why they chose not to defend this action in the way that we have. But we're defending.
I think it has something to do with the way the district court ruled. I mean, the way our Kimberly won.
I think that they thought they might be making bad law if they came up here again, and they have other programs to worry about. But we think that the first decision did not dispose of the issues and the defenses that we're raising here. The first Kimberly decision does not discuss the text of the contract at all. And I'll just say, the contract protects Kimberly in the event that future regulations inconsistent with the express terms of the statute are passed by the Farmers Home Administration. It does not say the same thing about congressional enactments. Similarly, the contract between Kimberly and the government says that the government is not bound by certain future laws. It says nothing about Kimberly. There is just no way to look at the contract in this case and conclude that Kimberly bargained to be exempted from a statute by ALIPA. They bargained to be able to prepay, as Holmes says, noted in both the Souter decision and the Scalia decision in Windstar, as Holmes says, that's an obligation on the government's part to insure Kimberly against a situation where it can't prepay. But that does not mean that ALIPA gets ignored. That what happens here is that the government has to be stuck in the...
There was another sort of fundamental, but there was another sort of basic problem here, and that was when you filed the notice of appeal from the judgment.
Your Honor, we relied on the Seventh Circuit's position in Synthroid. When the government appealed, we looked at the law and concluded that we could not appeal because we were not a party. But with the government having an appeal pending, we didn't think a contingent notice of appeal was necessary to preserve our position. As soon as we learned that the government was settling and dropping its appeal, we looked at the Synthroid decision and we did what Judge Easterbrook suggested in that.
Is there any Ninth Circuit Court case that you know of that allows you to rely on what the Seventh Circuit did in Synthroid?
I know of no case, either pro or con.
Not yet.
The Brennan case, Your Honor, from the Ninth Circuit in the 70s, which is cited in Kimberly's brief, suggests that the judgment could be vacated in order to award full relief to an intervener in situations like this. But it doesn't reach the question because it decided that the motion for intervene in that context was properly decided in the district court.
You've got about 2 minutes.
I would like to reserve it if I could, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Robert Bakes for the respondent, Kimberly. 3 years ago, this Court decided the very issue that the appellant in this action is trying to raise again. The Court determined that ALIPA was not a sovereign act, and therefore it could not modify Kimberly's contract with the government. And that contract specifically provided that Kimberly could prepay its loan at any time and exit the 515 program. And I'm referring to the loan agreement, which is the excerpts of record, tab 1, paragraph 6, page 19, which says specifically, so long as the loan obligations remain unsatisfied, the partnership shall comply with all appropriate FMHA regulations. This court ruled in Kimberly 1 that when Kimberly tendered the final balance due on its contract, on its promissory note, it had the absolute right to prepay that and exit the program. That is your decision in Kimberly 1. The United States Supreme Court followed your decision, followed the analysis of your Kimberly 1 decision in Franconia, the very same thing. The issue there was not whether you could get quiet title, which, by the way, I might add parenthetically, is a statutory remedy. They keep saying, well, a government breach, but you're limited to damages. But the Congress has enacted specifically 28 U.S.C. 2410, which says that if we have paid off our contract, we can quiet our title from the government. So you can get equitable relief. Congress has authorized equitable relief. And that was confirmed by the United States Supreme Court in the Union Oil Company, where they granted equitable relief and allowed them to rescind the contract and get their deposit back. And so when the Supreme Court decided Franconia, it used the same analysis that you did. It said the government, as a private contracting party, cannot pass legislation, which it said when it passes legislation, it is a repudiation of the contract, and the injured party can either sue then or can sue when they actually tender the balance due on the contract and the government refuses to take it. But they use the same analysis that it's not a sovereign act when the government enacts legislation or regulations which specifically point at a group, a contract, or a group of contracts and say, we're going to modify them. Otherwise, as Judge O'Connor said in the oral argument, she said, why would anyone contract with the government if the government all have to do is pass a statute and they can modify the contract? And I think, as Justice Scalia said, any contract which permitted that would be illusory at best because the government could modify it at any time. You don't have a contract. And so this court was correct when it decided Kimberly 1.
Not exactly what the Supreme Court did in the gold cases.
The what?
In the gold payment cases, not exactly what they did. They said, we won't pay you in gold anymore.
I don't remember the gold cases, but I do remember Lynch, which was back in 1927, in which they tried to modify the veterans' insurance contracts. And the Supreme Court said, you can't focus on these specific contracts. Now, the issue gets down to whether it's a general and a public purpose. And this court said specifically in Kimberly 1 that, and the Supreme Court said in Franconi when it was interpreting these precisely same documents, that this was not a public or a general purpose. It was, as you said, a narrowly focused statute trying to relieve the government of its obligations under a distinct group of contracts. And you said that is not a sovereign act, and the government cannot modify these contracts. And so we don't.
Is there any way the district court could have gotten around that? I mean, just from.
I can't think of any. You posed the question. I often thought, what would have happened if. And they petitioned, the counsel for these Doe petitioned this court for to file an amicus brief, and did when the government petitioned for rehearing. And this court denied the rehearing. And rehearing in bank, and the Solicitor General, after two extensions, refused to file a certiorari petition of the Supreme Court in Kimberley. Now, had this case gone back to the district court, and had the district court granted them permission to intervene, and had ruled the way they asked this court to rule, which is just contrary to Kimberley, this court would have been rightfully upset because the district court did not follow your remand order, which you read part of it.
I didn't read all of it.
The last one is, to prevent enforcement of private contracts between third parties and trustees would give the government as contractor powers that private contracting parties lack. And then you say, quoting from the Federal Circuit, Yankee Atomic Electric, such a result cannot be countenanced because the government in its private contracting capacity cannot exercise sovereign power for the purpose of altering, modifying, obstructing, or violating the particular contracts into which it had entered with private parties. It can't do that. Now, your decision in Kimberley 1 has become the standard in the United States. The Federal Circuit has now followed it. Just in the last month, the Federal Court of Claims in a damage action followed and quoted extensively from your Kimberly decision, holding that that ELIPA was not a sovereign act and therefore it can't modify the contracts with these property owners, and therefore they have a cause of action in the Federal Court of Claims for damages. But in this case, we have a cause of action for quiet title because Congress has specifically granted authority to the district courts to quiet title if the government has a lien to which they're not entitled. And they said, once we tendered the final balance due on this contract, Kimberly was released from its obligation under this agreement. And so the district court entered a quiet title judgment in favor of Kimberly. At the same time, he denied their motion to intervene. They appealed from their motion to the denial of the motion to intervene within 10 days, I think on the 23rd of December. But they never appealed from the quiet title judgment for 155 days. Now, when the government's a party, all parties have 60 days to appeal. And this court has held regularly that the timely filing of a notice of appeal is jurisdictional.
Well, they couldn't have filed a notice of appeal. They weren't parties below.
Well, I don't understand the
they weren't parties.
I don't understand the rationale of the Syndicate case, because they're saying you file a contingent springing notice of appeal, and that
well, if the denial to intervene is overturned, then your notice of appeal is effective.
Yeah, but you still shouldn't, and I think it should be the rule of this circuit.
What's wrong with that?
Well, it should be filed within the 60 days. Otherwise, who knows when if the case's appeal goes back to the district court and another intervener comes in and they're denied and they go up to this court and this court reviews it, and then the appeal time goes on interminably.
I don't quite follow that example, but I understood what Judge Easterbrook thought was a reasonable thing to do.
Well, my sense is that
it seemed to me that it was that unreasonable.
Well,
because as the case law recognizes, the interveners can't when they were denied leave to intervene, they could not file a notice of appeal.
Well, the case is
also not appeal the judgment.
The case is also recognized that an appeal that's filed more than 60 days from the entry of the judgment, this court loses jurisdiction. Now, you have to reconcile those two lines of authority.
If you can't file a notice of appeal, what difference does it make?
Wouldn't the clerk just have struck the notice of appeal the same way as if it had been filed by the Oakland Raiders?
Well, we filed a motion to dismiss the appeal on the ground of lack of jurisdiction, no case or controversy, which gets back to Judge Tashima's argument that the issue is moot.
If you haven't addressed the merits of the motion to intervene. What about the appeal from the denial of the motion to intervene?
They can address that. And there is a case, and one of the panelists said, well, why don't you just sue the government? Well, they have, in fact, done that. We implemented the record with there's a class action pending in Oregon of Goldammer versus Veneman, which is against the Secretary of Agriculture, in which they are litigating with who they should be litigating. Their problem is with the government. Their argument is really with the Solicitor General, because he didn't petition the United States Supreme Court for certiorari when they lost Kimberly.
Are they barred in any way by the statute of limitations and having started that action when they did?
Which?
The one in Oregon that you're talking about.
I don't know. I wouldn't think so.
That been raised as a defense?
No. Well, it hadn't proceeded that far. And we, one of the partners in this, Kimberly, was also sued over there, so we are in that action. And have been mediating with before Judge Levy just last Thursday to try and see if we can't resolve those cases over there. But what these litigants want to do, it's not that this tenant is in jeopardy in any way, and I really object to counsel's
be evicted.
That's what he said, and of course the record in this action shows that immediately after this court issued its opinion, Kimberly entered into a contract to sell this Kimberly property to a nonprofit corporation, which is its business is to preserve these properties and obtain subsidized housing, and it does have a subsidized housing contracts with HUD, the Department of Health and Urban Development.
So that's Section 8 housing, though, right?
Section 8 housing. And so
that's different than 515 housing?
Well, it's different than 515, but this never has had 515 subsidy on it. It was always, even though it was financed by rural housing, it was always subsidized by HUD. So nothing has changed. There is no jeopardy to this tenant. That is all. This tenant is a stalking horse in order for them to try and get the issue that you raised in Kimberly 1 back up here to try and either get you a different panel to reverse Kimberly 1 and not follow the law of the case, and then try and get the United States Supreme Court to take certiorari. And that's what this case is really all about. And the question is, the sole issue is, if there is jurisdiction here, did the trial court abuse his discretion in not letting them intervene? And so for that, you have a four-part test. Was it timely? And the stage of the proceedings which they sought to intervene was after this court had established the law of the case. Now they want to go back, intervene, and ask the district court, to reverse or not follow your decision, and then take an appeal back up here and ask this court, a different panel, to decide Kimberly differently than it did before. And failing that, they will then want to try and petition the United States Supreme Court for certiorari, something that the Solicitor General did not do because, in my opinion, he must have felt that Kimberly was the right decision, and all the other courts that since then have been following Kimberly. And
oh, it's nice to know that somebody likes our opinion.
You got to be proud of it because usually they're trying to set it aside. The other courts, and particularly the courts that are dealing with this, the Federal Court of Claims,
somebody's haranguing us for something.
And
all right.
Following yours and citing it, and you have your Kimberly decision has become, and it's the right decision, because it gets to the question of can the United States government, through legislation, focused on contracts and modify a contract and say we're not going to live up to this contract, we're going to change the terms of it. If they could do that, this was a 50-year loan. Why couldn't they change it, say it's 500 years and lock you in forever?
Well, you might have, I think what counsel says, you might have a claim for breach of contract by the government on just that basis that you change the rules on us and you,
we do.
You've caused us damage, and therefore, why wouldn't money be a sufficient
adequate remedy? In real property law, if you're talking common law, damages is never adequate when it comes to title to real property. That's basic common law. But the other thing is the Congress has specifically given the district courts authority to quiet title and equitable remedy. And that's the most recent expression of congressional will. It's later than the original Tucker Act damages case. And the last reenactment of the Tucker Act, it was the same act of Congress, included both the Tucker Act damages provision and the quiet title remedy. So we're not here. It isn't a question of we have an adequate remedy at damages. We don't at common law, but we have a specific statutory congressional remedy in quiet title. And that's why your decision in Kimberly 1.
I gather our Kimberly 1 just really only impacts those, we said estimated 5,000 projects before the effective date of ALIPA. Any developer, or whatever, who entered into a contract after ALIPA is stuck with having to comply.
Well, of course, anyone after ALIPA, their contracts are different. They don't.
Right.
They modified their contracts, and they specifically
different
say,
ballgame after the effective date of ALIPA.
And that's the problem. This was kind of a gigantic bait and switch, if you want to ask it. We got into this program because there were special tax advantages up until 1986 when Congress took away the tax advantages. And this is spelled out in the most recent Court of Claims case. And then when everybody started paying off the contracts to get out of this program because they were no longer economically viable, the government locked you in with the ALIPA statute. And so as the industry likes to describe it, it was a gigantic bait and switch. And so that's why most people filed damage cases in the Court of Claims. We tendered the balance due and filed quiet title. And that has become the leading case. Kimberly 1 has become the leading case in the industry. You can now go either way or both ways because you are damaged. Kimberly hasn't been getting any return on a negligible return on a $700,000 investment for 7 years. At a 10% return average, that's $420,000. That, 7 years, that's $500,000 that Kimberly has lost because it's locked into this government program. And I, one last thing about what the appellant stated, that this thing about suggesting or intimating that we might have violated a court restraining order. In our settlement agreement, which is an appendix to our brief, when we settle with the government after the district court, it's a paragraph, it's a tab 7 or 8 of our brief, excuse me, 9, the litigation settlement agreement of the appendix to our brief. That's the settlement agreement in February 27th of 2003 that we entered into with the government. And at that time, under that settlement agreement, the judgment, quiet title judgment, had been entered in December of 2002. The government took a protective notice of appeal. We had a very substantial attorney's fees claim against the government because of the nature of this transaction. And we settled with the government. We waived our attorney's fees claim. They agreed to waive it, their appeal, and they agreed to reconvey the property, and which they did. They reconveyed the property shortly after the first part of March. And we were obligated under the settlement agreement to file a satisfactory judgment, which we did. Now, it's been intimated here that we violated some stay order by this court. Those occurred, as almost by clear recollection, those occurred long before this court entered its stay order. And we were obligated to do it under the government. We would have breached our settlement and agreed with the government if we had not entered the stay of execution or satisfaction of judgment after the government reconveyed the property. So we're now at the position where it's been 7 years after we tendered the money. We've not gotten any return on this property, and we're here litigating again the precise same issue which this court decided in Kimberly 1 and which is now the accepted analysis of these government contracts in all the courts that have addressed it since Kimberly. And we request the court to accept the trial court's decision that they were too late. The law of the case had been established when they sought to intervene, and that Kimberly has been substantially prejudiced because of their late delay, and that there's now nothing, the issue is moot, and we ask the court to affirm the district court's order denying the right to intervene and to dismiss the appeal.
Let me ask this question. In this last stay order, the one issued by the Ninth Circuit on May 7, 2003,
yes,
there's a paragraph that says, appellant's motion for an OSC is granted, and Kimberly shall show cause in writing why sanctions shouldn't be imposed for violating the court's March 26 order. You remember that?
Yes.
Did you file a response to that OSC?
We did.
And what was your response? Did all this happen before the stay was...
All that happened before, and there was no jeopardy to these people because what we were doing was preserving this property for these tenants and not jeopardizing the tenants. And the court denied that. The motions judge denied the...
Sanctions were denied?
Sanctions were denied, yes.
Thank you.
I'll try to cover a lot of ground quickly. Judge Bakes said that the government agreed in the settlement agreement to reconvey the property, and respectfully, that's just not the case. Once the district court entered judgment below, the government no longer had an interest in the property. It only had the ability to appeal. All that the government could offer to do in the settlement agreement is drop its appeal. So that's why the settlement agreement doesn't moot our appeal from the judgment entered below.
Was there a quiet title provision in the judgment? I can't remember.
I don't recall. Judge Paez, you asked whether we could just sue the government in Boise. And I think the answer to that is Kimberly is trying to transfer the property to a third party. It's not clear to me that if Kimberly transfers to a third party that we'll have any adequate remedy under the APA suing the government. So that's our concern. That's why we want to reverse the judgment and continue litigating in this action. On the question of what the first decision of this Court decided, Judge Bakes said that it held that it's not a sovereign act when the government repudiates the contract. That is true only within the meaning of the Sovereign Acts Doctrine under Winstar. It doesn't mean that it's not still an act of Congress. And that's exactly the premise that Franconia rests on. Franconia doesn't say that ALIPPA wasn't effective. It said it was effective and repudiated a contract and awarded contract damages. That's exactly what we say should happen here. No doubt the government's contract with Kimberly has been breached, and no doubt Judge Bakes' client should recover damages for the lost income that he describes. At least they won't get any opposition from Ms. Doe. That does not mean that they can quiet title when an express statute ordered RHS not to accept the tender of prepayment. And the last thing I'll say about
how do you meet the point made by counsel that this is, in effect, is a quiet title action to real property and damages are never considered to be an adequate remedy for possession of real property?
Your Honor, Kimberly knew when it contracted with the government in the early 80s that this was a contract relating to real property, and Kimberly did not bargain for an exemption from future acts of Congress. If they'd wanted the relief that they were seeking for now, they could have bargained for it then. What they got, according to the ordinary contract principles described in Winstar, both Justice Souter and Justice Scalia, quoting Judge Holmes, what they got was insurance from the government, that if the government breached the contract, they could collect money damages. They did not bargain to be exempted from a future act of Congress such as ALIPPA. And the last thing I'll say is that unmistakability doctrine is a tool of contractual interpretation. The doctrine is an attempt to figure out what the contract between the parties meant. The earlier panel decision never interpreted the contract here. That's what we're at. We would have asked the district court to do, and that's what we ask this court to do. The contract between Kimberly and the government does not entitle them to the relief that they're seeking. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank both counsel. This case is submitted for decision. Next case on the argument calendar is Samish Indian Tribe versus the United States.